Time for breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is a crowded table of wounded children, parents, spouses, caregivers, and weary souls. Together, we join in honest conversations about the behaviors and challenges of parenting and working with children who have experienced trauma. There's always room for one more at the table to share in the stories, science, and healing as we learn to better understand and care for each other. We are a table without shame or judgment, because life can be hard and lonely, and we all know that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I'm Stacy. I'm a mother of 7 children and have fostered for over 13 years. As an RN and former public school teacher, I quickly realized this type of parenting was not taught in a textbook or class. Let's learn together to parent different, not harder. Welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. Welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. My name is Stacy. I am so glad that you could join us today. And I'm also so excited to have with me Dr. Adam Dell. And I'm just going to run through who Adam is and then let him start talking, because I just want to fill the whole show with his words of wisdom and advice. Dr. Adam Dell is board certified in clinical psychology. He currently serves as director of emotional well-being at the Notre Dame Wellness Center. Dr. Dell is based in Indiana, right?
Indiana, yep,
South Bend. Indiana, right? Yep. And honestly, what's so cool about him is he just had a baby. And also, he was bragging about the baby sleeping through the night. So we can all start out disliking him maybe immensely. But what I love about Dr. Dell is, number one, he's got all the letters behind his name to know all the things, but he has been a foster parent and has lived the life of parenting children from hard places, and has worked with so many people around PTSD, including our veterans, that he just has such a wealth of information, but has also lived it. So I feel like he's just the perfect guest to have come on to talk to us about when helping hurts, when we are helping and it starts to just wear us down. So thank you so much, Adam, for being here with us today.
Oh, thank you, Stacy. What an honor. Yeah.
You know, did I miss anything, like any type of major awards or maybe a Nobel Peace Prize? I don't know if I got that down there or not.
No, yeah, just such an honor to be here and hopefully to share in this 2-part series, really focused on the helpers and some of the costs that come with caring. This is something I'm really passionate about. And whether I was an officer in the Air Force or as a psychologist now at the University of Notre Dame in their wellness center, I've always tried to make space in my life for students or seminars for clinicians, teachers, providers, to try to pour into them and equip them, because the work that they do is costly, and even the best of people are people at best.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you mentioned it's a 2-part series. What we want to do is, first, we want to unpack understanding burnout, understanding and some of the concepts around that. But then also the second part is going to be more application driven. So you're going to want to tune into both. Can you just start out and really just define vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, caregiver, compassion fatigue, burnout? Sure. I mean, there's so many phrases that are coined.
Yeah, well, and maybe the good place to start, really, for many people listening to the podcast here, whether you love a kid in your life or you've, you know, dedicated your life through education, training, and vocation to, you know, caring for others, is really kind of the positive side of caring, which behavioral science literature oftentimes refers to that as compassion satisfaction. This is typically the why, the reason that someone endeavored in this direction in the first place. Compassion satisfaction is something that's often found in heaps and piles when we start a journey towards a profession or we take on a caregiver role. And it's the positive side of helping. It has to do not just with like the positive emotions associated with helping others, but also, you know, the drivers and the motivators that keep people committed and effective in their work. Oftentimes, you know, we're going to talk about sort of the other side of the coin with the costs of caring, but, you know, really connecting with compassion satisfaction. Why did I get involved with this in the first place? And what's inside of this now that touches on my core convictions? That's going to be really, really critical. In fact, as a psychologist, you know, whether I'm almost for anyone that I'm working with, I oftentimes try to to lead early on with the hypothesis that we tend to hurt the most where we care the most, that symptoms of burnout or even frustration, depression, sadness, anxiety, insecurity, shame, guilt, these things that we've labeled as bad, I don't know that they're bad. They're typically unwanted emotions. But if you think of them as signposts to significance in our heart, we tend to hurt a great deal, and you can trace it down to things that we care about. For example, when we grieve, it always traces down to love. When we're anxious, it almost always traces down to the reality that something we care dearly for is being threatened. Even in moments of intense insecurity, we oftentimes can trace that down to some place in the human heart of wanting to be enough, wanting to make a difference, wanting to be pleasing in the eyes of God or of others. And so it's really important, I think, when we talk about something like, and we'll sort of differentiate vicarious trauma versus secondary traumatic stress or compassion fatigue. Those are sort of like things that have some difficulty associated with them. But deep down, I think they're pointing to there's someone or some organization, there's something here that I care a lot for, but I'm not showing up in the way that I'd like to or that I used to, or it's not having the effect that I'd like it to have. So I always like to lead with that. And then, you know, so I don't know, many people listening may be familiar with sort of an older book now, but it's called The Giving Tree.
Oh, and, yeah, that's the book that you can cry about.
Yeah, well, and, you know, there's really sort of a lot of emotion about that book. Like if you just do an internet search, like there are many, many, many people that have literally tattooed images from that book on their body because they so identify with it. And then there's other huge groups of people that are like, this should be a book that is banned. This is basically emotional abuse. Like, this is promoting someone dying in the service of another, getting slowly sliced away. You know, it's like, there's a lot of opinions about it. But I think, like, what at least what that book is highlighting is that, like, in order to really love someone, sometimes it means we give parts of ourselves away. If even the best of people are people at best, we could give too much, or we could expect from ourselves more than we're actually capable of giving. And there's almost like a line that can be crossed where my helping is not only harmful to me, but it actually might not be the most loving thing for this person. You know, when I was an officer in the Air Force, I'd oftentimes go to groups of commanders, and, you know, they would be very interested in knowing how to address issues in a fairly young demographic of service members, you know, people in their 20s or maybe their 30s who drink too much or become violent or, you know, engage in sexual assault and other nefarious behaviors. And also, how do we support these young people that have, you know, major emotional issues that they bring with them into the service? And it's like, often I would tell them, like, to make sure they have a revolving door policy where anybody could come in to see them, but that they would be very clear in their own intention of what their scope of practice was, so to speak, such that if someone came in and they had a very, very clinical issue going on, medical, psychiatric, or otherwise, that you'd walk right back out that revolving door to the helping agency, that you didn't have this kind of one-stop shop, open door. I can be your counselor and your priest and your physician and all of that, but that they would have a really clear understanding of sort of the limits of their own competency, such that they could, you know, leverage the strengths of other helping organizations. And, you know, I think it's a Herculean thing to care for a young person or to care for someone that has a mental illness, regardless of their age. And sometimes I think we sort of take on more responsibility than we're really trained or equipped to do. So in terms of, you know, this whole like vicarious trauma, secondary traumatic stress, I would say that there's quite a bit of dispute in the research community as to what really differentiates these things. And there's enormous amounts of overlap. So I'm not sure any of them are purely homogenous. There's overlap between these things. But in general, you know, vicarious trauma, and I realize when we talk about something like this, Stacey, we're all looking at this through the lens of our own lived experience. All of us who've ever cared for anyone has experienced some of this. And then, you know, it just becomes becomes more and more complex if you're taking care of someone that they themselves have a really complex trauma, abuse, neglect type history, or just suffers in the throes of episodic mental illness, et cetera. But Vicarious Trauma, Sprang is an author, I think an article was written in 2019 that basically defined vicarious trauma as repeated indirect exposure to trauma with someone that you care about. So you have some sort of empathic entanglement with this person, and you're repeated through their life, and because you're proximate to them, to repeated indirect exposures to trauma. And it can actually result in maladaptive or unhealthy adjustments. These things can affect the person who's being vicariously traumatized in eerily similar ways to the person who themselves is experiencing the trauma. So it can start to change how a person views themselves, others, the world, even the future. And as somebody who's been trained in a lot of trauma therapy modalities, these are the very things that we talk about in therapy with survivors of various forms of trauma. It's sort of like that sort of index trauma event happened in your life. And how has it shaped the way you view yourself, God, the world, other people, future, et cetera. So vicarious trauma is kind of constructivist in its nature. All that really means is that it really emphasizes changes to thinking over other forms of trauma symptomatology. We know that there's more physiological manifestations of trauma after effects like hypervigilance or exaggerated startle response, affective things that like mood-based things. But vicarious trauma really tries to say, hey, this is a unique lens on the costs of caring by saying, because I care for someone and I've been exposed to indirect trauma, now I see the world, myself, and other things quite differently. Secondary traumatic stress is a label used to describe the more observable trauma symptoms. So whereas vicarious trauma focuses on, in particular, the way in which someone thinks after these indirect exposures, secondary traumatic stress has a lot to do with, you know, I'm close to trauma unfolding in someone's life. I'm trying to intervene even as a helper in this way, but I'm starting to develop sort of hypervigilance patterns, and I'm starting to become avoidant. I'm starting to avoid certain things that might remind me of similar trauma cues or reminders. I have an intensification of emotions and arousal, even intrusive thoughts. And I don't know about all of your listeners, but I think many would relate to the idea of like sometimes when you're leaning into the hell of somebody's reality or their history, you hear things that like you just could never have fully been prepared to hear, or you observe things for which you don't have like a box of comprehension in your mind, you know, preceding it. It's sort of like, I can't imagine a human being doing that to another human being. I could have never sat down if somebody asked me to think of the most, you know, duplicitous things one person could do to another or one child could experience in a single lifetime. I could have never conceived of this. And yet it happened to someone I love or care for. And
I was just going to say, so, and I resonate with what you're saying of leaning into the hell of another's reality, especially in the context of whether they're in your classroom or then you're in your home. One of the things that I struggle with in understanding, and maybe you have some advice, especially for a teacher or for foster adopt families, I'm leaning into someone's hell of reality, but I can't share that hell of reality. There's some confidentiality there in that sense. So it's almost like you're taking it on this and heaping it on, and it's just setting. So let's talk about teachers specifically or a foster family. What are your recommendations for that family in order to lean into this, but then not just be scorched down and burned out by it?
That's a great question. And there really are three or four principles that go beyond sort of the label of self-care, which I always kind of cringe a little bit when I hear that word thrown around for clinicians or teachers or foster families. Because as you well know, Stacey, and many of the folks hearing this, like this kind of trauma exposure that actually has a personal effect on you is going to require more than a bubble bath and a scented candle
I'm like praise hands
deal.
right now for you saying
Yeah.
that, right?
Like
Like
now there might be some people that are like, listen, like part of this solution for me is XYZ plus the bubble bath and the scented candle. I say that's terrific, you know. But really, I mean, I think that's maybe at least in part why any conversation about this needs to start with a compassion satisfaction component. You know, I think of like psychological theorists like Viktor Frankl, who wrote A Man's Search for Meaning, having been liberated from a Nazi death camp as a physician and a Jewish physician, and you know, imprisoned in a Nazi death camp, somehow survived that, got to the other side of it, and had things to say like, if a person has a why, they can bear almost any how. And one of the really quintessential aspects of burnout or compassion fatigue or these other two constructs we've talked about, secondary traumatic stress or vicarious traumatization, is people increasingly sort of have a distance between themselves and why they got involved in this in the first place, or they're increasingly out of touch with the compassion satisfaction part. And I want to clarify that doesn't mean that, like, therefore they should always feel good about the caring that they're doing. But I think that like chasing happiness all the time is actually a really unhappy quest. It's sort of like, but chasing the wonder and the meaning associated with having the opportunity to do something different in this person's life, or the privilege of at least showing up to that opportunity, it can be really critical. Now, in the second part of this, I'd actually like to invite folks to personally participate in an exercise that I use in therapy a lot that can really help personalize some of this in terms of radical acceptance and self-compassion, which I think those are the ingredients that go far beyond mere kind of like self-care.
What you said that I really resonated with was chasing the wonder or the meaning. And I think for me, like what I have done, we've been through a rough season, and I started realizing that the way I started my day was not a good way to start my day. And so then I decided that every morning I was going to start with gratitude, find something that I felt grateful for in some way. And it really has kind of changed my perspective of like, events happen. Everyone has hard things in life. Life happens. No one is getting out of this life unscathed per se. No one has the perfect seamless life. But if you can stay anchored and centered in yourself, like, and for me, I have a relationship with Christ, so I stay anchored in that, knowing like, you know what, life happens, and I'm going to start with gratitude. And I love that chasing wonder and meaning, because if you stay anchored to what the meaning is in your life, then yeah, life can happen, and you're going to stay anchored in. And I think that's kind of what you're saying in that is.
Yeah, you know, and I've stolen this from Laurie Santos at Yale, who's taught the most well-attended course in all of Yale University history. In fact, I think you can take the class online for free. It's called Happiness in the Good Life. And she has a number of exercises in that course because gratitude is so salient to flourishing, not necessarily always to happiness, but to human flourishing. She'll encourage everyone in the class to maintain this discipline through the 12 or 16-week course of every day. They write down something else they're grateful for, and they can never repeat the same thing twice. But then far more impactful for most students in their feedback is once a week, they actually write a letter to someone from their distant past or right now to thank them for something very specific. And ideally, you'd read this to them and then give them it, or you'd mail it, or you'd call them and read. It's a deeply emotional thing, something that would only take a few moments out of the day, at least for the daily exercise. My family, we have mason jars in our home for the 16, almost 17 years of marriage that my wife and I have been together, with little slips of paper and a pen. And each jar, you know, we've got one, it's right behind me, actually, it says 2023, little different strips of paper. And we'll write down, you know, the date and something, you know, so it was Amelia Joy was born, you know, last month, certainly goes in there, but also small things like, oh, I got to come on this podcast with Stacy. And we intentionally put small things in there because when the skies grow dark and threatening and our hearts have no music in them and we're tempted to despair, like what a joy to be able to see a jar on my bookshelf that says 2009 and empty its contents on the floor and be reminded afresh of things that I'm grateful for that I could have never remembered if somebody just sat me down and said, what happened in July of 2009? So yeah, I think like those types of practices actually are very much connected to self-compassion, but also certainly positive religious coping, or even just the science of well-being.
I am 100% going to add a mason jar to my dining room table with my kids, because what was exciting to me yesterday was something happened the day prior that normally in this season of time for me, I would feel very cynical about or probably have a bad attitude. But it was really bizarre because I woke up feeling grateful for that having happened, saying, I'm so glad that this happened because, and it was just like, wait, something in the past that normally would have been an added heap of crap on my plate became this thing where I felt very grateful for it. And I just see my mind kind of mindset changing a little bit. And so I love the idea of it being a actual physical representation with slips that you can go back, almost like you were talking about signposts earlier, right? This is a signpost to why you got into this in the first place, and the blessings along the way, or the things to be grateful for along the way.
No, and it's like the ancient Jewish kind of principle of an Ebenezer, a stone of remembrance. It's I mean, I just can't tell you how many times, I wouldn't have known it when we started this, but how many times, even just in a moment of discouragement, to see that many jars filled with that many slips of paper, just to be reminded that, you know, that we're talking a little about trauma here and exposure, and our minds at a neurobiological level will encode with greater specificity and detail negative emotions or traumatic memories than neutral ones or even positive ones. Like, that's unequivocally true. And so I think we are wise, especially if we have willingly chosen. So like the World Health Organization would estimate that every human being on the planet will have at least 3 to 4 traumatic experiences in their life. But if we have willingly chosen to lean in to this type of work, where trauma exposure is so much more likely to occur to us or to people that we care or love, then I think that we do ourselves a favor by cultivating these types of disciplines around gratitude, not as an antidote or something, but just because this is how we remain connected and hopefully a little bit protected from only seeing the burden or only seeing like the negative outcomes. I would also say, Stacey, I mean, I might have a lot of letters after my name, but if my wife and I were asked honestly how we did with a dozen or more foster kids through our home over 8 to 10 years, or even 6 to 8 months of having a mother and her children living in our home who left a very traumatic environment, we were making mistakes constantly and constantly overwhelmed by the circumstances we found ourselves in. Like, it didn't matter how many classes we took. Like, I think the possibility of feeling like, oh my goodness, I don't have enough resources here to really meet the need, is an almost universal phenomenon if you're trying to lean in this way. And so, yeah, like these types of disciplines with gratitude and having them sort of symbolic or tangible is just like such a terrific reminder that immediately connects us, hopefully, to good things in our lives that add joy and punctuation marks of meaning, but also maybe just as importantly, connects us tangibly to the compassion satisfaction part, that there have been some wins along the way, some blessings. There have been some things in my life that have brought me to this very moment, and the good and the bad stuff make me who I am now. I can trust that moving forward.
I love that. I want to end with this question, but I also want to leave it open to Krista, our producer, to ask a question if she wants before we end and move to part two, where you're going to walk through an exercise with us. But let me ask you this, and I'm asked this question a lot. When do you stop? When do you, okay, think of working with a family member who's mentally ill, or you're working in the school and you have a student who just, it's just overwhelming. At what point when do boundaries come in? What does that look like in your mind?
I really, given that every circumstance is really different and there's complexities at an idiosyncratic level for the individual asking that question, like at what point do I have to say enough is enough, or I need to step back? Also, like the circumstance is really unique as well. So this is where I really feel that engagement with a third party, mentor, guide, agency, therapist, pastor, priest, these become really critical moments. Someone who's outside of your circumstance, who can ask you some really innocent and curious questions. I think like when you are immersed in a caring relationship like this, you don't know what's normal or abnormal because all you know is what you know. And you develop patterns of response and styles of relating. And you have these goalposts of expectations for yourself because that's just what it's been. Or, you know, I think it can be invaluable to have somebody very much outside the circumstance to serve as like a third party to bounce ideas off of and give you some feedback, not only for your own well-being, but also just sort of for a sanity check on this is what we've been doing. I remember there were different lessons I learned from being an officer in the Air Force. And I remember there were some leaders who would intentionally not learn a great deal about the mission that they were going to start commanding until they arrived the day that they arrived. And they would ask a million questions because they didn't want to just assume that this is the way things always go. They wanted to go into a new team, a new mission, a new part of the organization with totally fresh eyes and ears to say like, oh, that's really interesting. Why do you guys do it that way? And this is where, for me personally, Stacey, having friends that aren't even living in the same state, but that know me really, really well, even ask me the personal questions like about my weight, about my marriage, about how much alcohol I'm consuming, about how things are going in the context of my family, work, et cetera, who are way outside of this. It is just so protective in that regard. And again, very much attached to compassion, satisfaction, and self-compassion, right? Like many of the people listening to your podcast now are unequivocally convinced that other people matter, their stories matter, their pain matters, they need help and support, they need to be understood contextually in the context of their lived experience, what's happened to them and what they've done with that. And I think many times the best helpers I know are so much better at finding that wisdom for everybody else than they are for themselves.
I love your answer. I really do. I love that answer because it is so true when you are in the thick of crisis or the thick of hard, even in the workplace, when you're in the classroom and you just can't see your way out, it is so good to have that outside. No man is an island, right?
Yeah.
Chris, is there anything you wanted to add question-wise?
Yes. Episode? Yeah, I love hearing from you, Adam. And I love the fact that you say that, you know, caregiving is a universal role, right? I take care of my father who's got dementia. So I have been growing and becoming a caregiver. And I have this conversation with people a lot. I think sometimes we get stuck in comparing our caregiving to somebody else's caregiving. So like an example would be like, if I were to adopt some kids with trauma, I might look at myself and go, well, I'm not as good as a caregiver as Stacy, but Stacy's got years of experience. And I think there's a danger of comparing your caregiving skills to somebody else's caregiving skills, because I think you can only give as much as you can give where you start comparing your caregiving. So can you touch on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. We're always doing kind of left-right comparisons. I think that's just the kind of creatures we are. We're always sort of seeing how we measure up. And we are deeply social people as well. Like I remember in a social psych class I took once, there was this idea that you're never, ever alone, really. Because like even when I'm in the bathroom with the door locked all by myself, almost every behavior and thing I'm thinking in there has been socially derived. Like how I toilet, how I wash my hands, what I do when I look in the mirror. Like we are so influenced socially.
I'm never alone in the bathroom either, Adam.
Yeah, exactly.
Pounding on the door or their fingers under the door. Yeah. Mommy. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's like such a sweet, sad human reality that we're always kind of looking left and right and wondering like, do I measure up? And people even do this with their own trauma stories. It's like, well, you know, I know this other person that went through a great deal more than I did, or this person who's maybe taken on much more than I have.
Or I don't have a right to complain because that person has it worse than me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, no.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it was Philip Yancey that once said that a mystery is not the absence of meaning, it's the presence of more meaning than can be fully comprehended. And if any one of us finds ourselves in the mysterious circumstance where we are uniquely positioned to love someone else who's in need, there is like incalculable wonder and meaning and beauty and worth associated with that. Just as, you know, a mother of one child has a profound, profound opportunity not that different than a mother of two, you know, that there's something quixotic and feels like a high calling in someone's life to care at all. And I'll just leave with this. I one of the things I've learned having bounced around the country in different roles, military or civilian, is every time I arrive at an opportunity, whether it's with a new client that I'm seeing for therapy, or it's a new team I'm going to lead, or a new community we're going to live in, I always lean into that wondering, like, I wonder what the highlight of this is going to be for me. I wonder who the person is, or what the opportunity is, or what the breakthrough moment might be that might be in 5 years from now, the absolute high point of this. And so you kind of go into it saying it might actually be something kind of small. Like if I get to make a meaningful difference in a very practical way for this person, connecting them with services that'll help them, or simply giving them food or a bit of belonging and encouragement on a particular day. Honestly, I probably don't even deserve to have that kind of a role in someone's life, you know? And it's an enormous privilege to do it. So I don't need to compare how much I'm doing or what my qualifications are compared to someone else. Like I get to pivot to the here and the now with my values, seeking to contribute something. And that is a deeply meaningful way, I think, to live our lives.
Well, such incredible and wise words from Dr. Adam Dell today. And I encourage you to tune in to the next podcast where we will continue with him. And he's going to be doing an exercise with us, an application exercise, and you will not want to miss it. So thank you so much for being on today, Dr. Dell. I mean, just, I am sitting here taking notes and taking it all in, and just, I know I'm going to listen again and again, just from the information that you've given. So thank you.
Thanks.
We're so thankful that you all shared in today's conversation. We are always here and ready to set one more place at the table. Thanks for joining us on Trauma for Breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is brought to you and supported by Matt Force, working together to reduce substance abuse, and Yavapai County Community Health Services, working toward healthier communities.